what are the abstractions that I can introduce that introduce syntax sugar with the minimum amount of cognitive overhead?
That's James Simone, a lead software engineer here at Salesforce. I'm Josh Burke, your host for the Salesforce Developer Podcast. And here on the podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we sit down and talk with James about a wide variety of philosophical concepts of software engineering. We're going to talk about how we can try to move fast, but not break things. We're going to get into things like agile and pair programming and mob programming and recursion and refactoring and all sorts of fun stuff. But before we do, let's level set and ask James what his job exactly is here at Salesforce.
My current job at Salesforce is under the helm of our agile organization. My team helps build tools for all of the engineering teams in Salesforce to measure their productivity and happiness.
Nice. I like that you're measuring both productivity and happiness. What kind of tools are you using to track happiness?
Happiness is obviously a proxy. So There are things that we do like surveying engineers on a weekly or biweekly basis. It's opt-in, so they can choose to take the survey, for example, as frequently or as infrequently as they'd like. But then there are also some other interesting proxy measurements that we've introduced, not all of which, of course, you know, we can get into, but they are interesting. And I think that it's also fun to think about how those two things can be and data shows are related to each other.
Right, exactly. I mean, I have a feeling we're probably going to get back into some of that kind of stuff. But first, I want to give a shout out to the Changelog podcast, because that's an episode which brought us this conversation. They're a long format, so we're just going to talk some highlights. But what about this episode talking about the Ruby ecosystem caught your eye?
Well, I think it's an interesting one because the story, this is, I guess we'll link it out in the show notes, that podcast that happened recently with Justin Searles, who's a big member of the Ruby community. And the Ruby community as a whole is about twice as large as our own. Okay. And I find that interesting primarily because I think it speaks to just how large we as a group of developers are.
Right.
I mean, the Ruby ecosystem is massive.
Right.
And it stands to reason that half of massive is still pretty big. So We're at a size where you can't just go off and dismiss us as a couple of people working on a niche proprietary language anymore.
Right.
There's a lot of people globally using Apex, using Lightning Web Components. And I think that that's really important. The thing that's interesting hearing from somebody in the Ruby mindset is them talking about the language having more of an appreciation in different parts of the world, sort of a burgeoning global interest, while sort of a more passive Western reaction to Ruby, right? Like it's old hat or something.
Right.
And that's totally fine. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to continue to be excited about the work that we're doing, and especially realize that so much of modern software and the automations that, you know, multinational corporations to your small nonprofit are running on are these rock solid foundations that languages like Ruby and Apex, JavaScript provide to people.
Right. Well, I thought there was an interesting undertone there because they were talking about kind of the stability and growth of the Ruby ecosystem, even though you don't read about it in the news every other day like you kind of do with JavaScript. And I feel like there's a huge parallel to that. You know, like you're saying, we still have a pretty massive ecosystem, but it's not like we, you know, Apex hits Hacker News an awful lot. But I think there's another corollary, which is like, because I kind of got one of the beats from them was like, this is because Ruby just works. Like there's nothing really controversial to talk about. It doesn't make many headlines because it just sort of works. And I kind of feel like you could say that about our platform as well.
Absolutely. I think you're not going to see Apex introduces switch statement into syntax support on Hacker News back in 2018. You're not going to see the same thing today. Apex introduces query with bind support. Now you can access your query variables in a much easier and sustainable format, right? Like that's just not the kind of thing that is going to get massive amounts of upvotes, but these are actually really exciting improvements on the existing language.
Right. And I think that's, I think it's wonderful that Apex has gotten to a level of maturity that it just can get nerdier. Like, we're not even really necessarily fixing old stuff. We're just actually, you know, improving it on a base level kind of thing. Because once again, the guts and glory of it, just, they just work.
Absolutely. And there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah. And so it's kind of segueing that there's a saying in tech, go fast and break things, usually saying that even if you fail, that's not a bad thing because you can learn from your failings and move on to the next iteration. I have had product managers come on the show and say that Salesforce's philosophy is more of go fast, but don't break anything, because we do not want to break anything in our current version that we spent all that hard work putting out in the last version. What do you think of those phrases, and what do you think about the focus on like time and efficiency versus safety?
Yeah, my friends and I have this joke, gotta go fast, as though it's a license to operate recklessly, right? And to break things.
Right.
And I think that when we look at the influence that agile methodologies have had on software development and software development life cycles in general, there is this idea of duality that's been introduced, safety mm-hmm. versus speed, right? Mm-hmm. And we've been sold this idea that you can either have one or the other.
Right.
And I think that, to your point, something that we've really tried to shore up in our own release cycles that we've consistently tried to do with introducing new functionality without breaking existing functionality mm-hmm. is this idea that actually maybe this is more of the tortoise versus the hare, and slow and steady is the thing that wins right. the race. And that's the thing that I have specialized in and focused in over the last 7 years on embedded in various software development teams, watching as our internal velocity grows and grows. And it does so by doing things that are, again, not going to hit the front page of Hacker News. It's like, software team chooses to focus on technical debt, manages to hit all of their goals. Like, I wish that that was the thing that right. is trending, but right. it's just not that exciting to talk about. Like, yes, we went back and fixed a to-do that we wrote 5 months ago.
Right. It does cut back to the classic, you know, we're like train engineers. Nobody complains as long as the train keeps coming, you know, showing up on time. Like, it's when the train breaks down on the tracks, that's when it actually makes the headlines.
Right. And that, I think, is one of those things where when you think about what the statistic of like a 99% uptime really means, it is funny to break mm-hmm. it down and be like, well, actually, this looks like 3 days a year, we're going to have a problem. And of course, the thing that you're going to notice is those 3 days it's a year, three not days the 362. Yeah, exactly.
Totally, totally. Now, in my notes, you're referring to something you like to call the Midnight in Paris effect. And I'm going to be honest, I had totally forgotten about that movie. Avoiding spoilers, what did you mean by that?
Yeah, this is my favorite. And I think you don't have to have seen the movie. I think I rewatched it recently, and maybe that's how I got to thinking about it as I was listening to this Changelog podcast. Gotcha. But they're talking about how progress is more of a helix than it is some kind of linear line that you're drawing. And so you have these situations where you're sort of continually going back to the same thing, you're re-implementing the same thing, mm. right? Like you're mm-hmm. doing a new project, new package, new class, whatever it may be. And some of those things end up being the same. And I think that when we're in the process of sort of reinventing that wheel over and over again, it's easy to say like, oh, this is old hat, or it was better the last time mm-hmm. that I did it, or maybe it was better the first time that I did it. Or, you know, I'm looking back on these things on GitHub from the mid 2015, 2016, like that's the time period in which it would have been exciting to be doing this work. And if you're always mm-hmm. looking back and thinking that that was the best time period to have been doing this stuff, you tend to miss out on the present. Mm-hmm. I think that you could just as equally say that this is the golden age of Salesforce development. And actually, there's a lot of really exciting things that are new to the platform that are improving the DX of working on the platform all the time, mm-hmm. like the use of Data Weave to do things like parse XML responses. That would have been a nightmare before 2023. Right. It's not a nightmare anymore. It's actually right. quite simple, and it's performant. Like, yeah. these are things that I get excited about and I think about a lot.
Yeah. It does, like, having watched the platform over time, yeah, I think you're right. It's I think it's easy to underappreciate just the number of tools that work so incredibly well. Like back in my workshop days, I used to kind of wax whimsical whenever I was showing anybody the by distance filter, because I'm like, this was like the first thing I did in Visual Force and JavaScript, was trying to figure out how many accounts were in like a 5 mile radius of a building. And back then we didn't have sine and cosine in Apex. And if you want to do geometric math without sine and cosine, congratulations, you can't.
I loved that episode with you and David reminiscing about that. You know, I think what was the decision? It was like, well, maybe we could just use a square instead.
Just use a square.
Like, wouldn't that be easy? Yeah, that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Like, instead of trying to like hyperfixate on, okay, we absolutely need to hit this and this is exactly how we're going to do it. Like,
right.
Not over solutioning like that and being able to innovate
right.
on the spot is such an important part of the, I think, the things that make software development awesome.
Yeah. Because this is going to be a classic segue, because that was the decision. I spent a day researching whether or not I myself could replicate JavaScript's geometric functions in Apex. And that was the moment that I talked myself off the cliff. And I was just like, okay, before you do that, which you know somebody at Salesforce is going to get paid to do anyway, is, you know, what else could we do? And I'm like, is the client really going to care if it's a square or a radius? And the answer was they did not. And instead of writing, you know, like three new Apex libraries, I basically wrote like seven lines of code, which brings me to my next question. What does Yagmi mean?
Oh, yeah, that's the classic. You aren't going to need it, right? Right? And I think this is something that I think a lot about in terms of the different companies that I've worked at. Mm-hmm. I am always reminiscing about going into an interface and looking for usages of this interface and finding a single implementation.
Right.
Like that's the kind of gold plating that we should be trying to avoid.
Right.
I think that there is a time and a place for abstraction, absolutely. But when you're doing things just for the sake of having heard that you should do them, like, oh, I need to introduce an abstraction because we might need something to operate in the same way, but differently in the future.
Right.
Like, why not just do that in the future when you have the use case for it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and so to kind of dovetail into that, some of the stuff you've talked about is like building with intent, like building in the safety while you're trying to move fast. So kind of from an agile perspective, how do you know when to take the time to try to build out a framework like that, so you've got some future proofing versus not? Like, is there a tipping point?
We as a team have arrived at the usage of the quote unquote spike, which I say with my air quotes, because in case you're not familiar with that terminology, it's time that we're agreeing to set aside that we have specifically time boxed to say, what can we do? What's mm-hmm. possible? And also what's reasonable?
Mm-hmm.
And an example of that I can give from recent work that we've done is a GraphQL endpoint that we were working with. And there are some really interesting Apex libraries for working with GraphQL. Hmm. I think that they are really hyper-focused on something that we weren't necessarily interested in. And when we were looking at what it would look like to introduce that kind of library and continue to use it, mm-hmm. it didn't really make sense.
Right.
Like, oh, we're going to import 20 classes that we've gotten from this GitHub repository just in order to interact with this endpoint. Like, that's mm-hmm. the kind of cost that is probably too high, whereas we could, in the scope of maybe an hour max, mm-hmm. come up with something that, oh, okay, it's just capable of interacting with this endpoint in a way that's meaningful to us.
Right.
And if we need to further abstract it out later, we can do so.
Yeah. It reminds me of, like, I think I was one of the longest holding adherents to jQuery, like, on the planet. And I would get people asking, like, well, why don't you just build this out in, like, React? And I'm like, because I'm not I'm not building what you're building. I'm building a single page demo. I just needed to, you know, flip a few divs around and make the button go all flashy. You know, yes, if you're writing an enterprise web application that you're going to have to maintain for the next 5 years, by all means, go find a good app framework and, you know, and do that. But sometimes a little bit of code is actually going to go a long way.
Well, and, you know, this is another recent changelog podcast episode where they were reviewing the state of JS at the end of 2022. I think jQuery is still up there, Josh. You're not alone.
Really?
You're not operating in a room by yourself, my friend. There are a lot of people still using that dollar
sign. Oh, gosh. That's actually a little disturbing, just only because the DOM handling in native JavaScript has gotten so good.
It has.
It has kind of collapsed the old school browser wars sort of things. I think that's actually my usage of jQuery stopped after I didn't need its middle ground stuff, like how to do a modal window and stuff like that. Like so it's almost like I keep scaling back because, well, I almost don't code anymore. But what I was coding was mostly just exemplary stuff and not stuff that was actually going to have to pass an engineering review or anything like that.
But, you know, it's that intense usage of an adoption of something that so clearly helps to move ground that ends up spurring the inclusion of that stuff in the base language, right? Like it's gotten better because of jQuery, not because if jQuery didn't exist, I don't think that we would be seeing things like get elements by class name.
Oh yeah, accessible. Exactly. It's the history and evolution of the web. Like go back to the episode with Greg Whitworth where, you know, they're talking about it's basically just a bunch of shims. Like people figure out how to write a library that does this thing that the browser doesn't do until the browser could go later figure it out. And it's like, I don't know if that evolution's ever going to stop. You know, I think the shims and the libraries and the standards committees are always going to be like, well, if we want to try something new, we have to wave it, bolt something on until we can kind of bring it in sort of thing.
And I think that actually dovetails nicely back into the safety versus speed debate, because what I'm really advocating for and what I feel like I've been talking a lot about recently is how no abstraction has zero cost. That's exactly why I told the story about the GraphQL stuff. It's like when you're introducing things, it has that cognitive overhead associated with it. So something that I've been really hyper-focused on over the last year is what are the abstractions that I can introduce that introduce syntax sugar with the minimum amount of cognitive overhead? I want to keep things as close to the platform as I can while still giving people a clear and definitive reason for here's why you should use this over what already exists so that you're not just continually reinventing the wheel. But even if you are, you're getting faster at doing it.
By making smaller wheels, it sounds like.
I don't think, in this analogy, you probably aren't stacking the wheels. I feel like maybe there's somewhere in here that falls down. But Josh, exactly.
Tell me a little bit about where the developer lifecycle, especially from an agile point of view, like what it looks like. Let me rephrase this actually. When it comes to things like unit testing to help measure where your application is on this kind of scale of safety, so to speak, what makes for a good unit test and that what makes it for a bad unit test in that?
I think that obviously I have some bias, which we've previously discussed, but just to bring it back into the open, we operate with test-driven development, so we're writing the test first. And there, even with that bias being there, I think that something that makes a good unit test is it runs fast, it has a minimum of ceremony associated with it, which is typically setup or DML or things that you are needing to do that aren't actually necessary to exercise the code that you're looking to exercise. It's necessary because of some weird side effect that happens as part of that code. So a good test gets straight to the point. It tests, you provide input, you assert that the output for whatever that is, maybe it's just manipulating the input that you've provided, matches your expectations. And I think that when we either write tests first that do that or model our tests off of the code that we've already written, you frequently find yourself getting into the mindset of, oh, okay, but actually there's this other thing that I haven't considered. And that's another test.
Right.
And you start to self-document the edge cases to your product in a very organic and curiosity-driven way, which I think is a really powerful way to be applying our minds to programming mm-hmm. problems.
Yeah. I mean, it's always been kind of a dividing line in the ecosystem. It's like I don't know if dividing lines, right? We put such a spotlight, though, on code coverage because that's the thing we force developers to do, right? You can't deploy to production without 75% or above code coverage.
It's a line that we've drawn in the sand, right?
Right. And it's like, that's great because less than 75% code coverage that's a pretty good number, right? Like if you're dipping into the 60%, your unit tests are probably not doing their job. But to your point, like once you hit that code coverage, you might still have 4 unit tests to write. Because you might have, 3 or 4 edge cases or personas or things that could go boom that your current unit test doesn't cover.
Yeah, this goes back to the sort of legendary consultant I++ test method, right?
Where you're just like nemesis, yes.
You're just boosting that test coverage with lines of code. I think about this in my open source work a lot, where I use codecov.io to measure code coverage and mm-hmm. It is funny how a lot of the times I find that my code coverage is actually decreasing because I'm mm-hmm. removing lines of code, which means that the unmeasured lines of code that I haven't actually hit for whatever reason end up taking up a greater percentage of that class and of the program as a whole, right?
Yeah.
And I always have to laugh at that because some of these diffs that I'm generating, I'm like, wow, I removed 60 lines of code today. And I updated 200. Like, I think that's a really powerful ratio because all of my tests are still passing. I know
at
the very least I haven't introduced a new bug that I already knew about. That's not to say that, there are a lot of bugs I don't know about. And I'm working on those as soon as I find them. But I have such a feeling of safety. And yet when I look at my code coverage percentage, it's going down. So am I improving? I think I'm improving. But my code coverage measurement is not improving. And that's where I think that disconnect occurs.
Yeah, totally agreed. And I think it created a false idol in the sense of always strive for 100% code coverage. Like that is some noble goal to achieve. And having spent like back in my days as an actual developer, like spent like a good portion of a day trying to figure out why that one, if statement isn't getting hit because maybe there's something on the platform that isn't communicating it to right. Ask yourself the question, are you actually, if you accomplish this, are you actually going to feel more confident in the application? Or are you just accomplishing this because you want to get 1% code coverage back up?
Right. And I think when you're attuned to where it's meaningful, you can definitely understand like, okay, yeah, maybe it sounds like 75% is actually a really positive thing to pin to. And mm-hmm. we can definitely all aspire to hitting that metric. It makes sense. But you really, once you're at like 90 something percent, maybe start to question, are you just doing this to boost this artificial metric or are you looking to exercise something meaningful?
Right, exactly. Let's flip this over to the other side of Agile and TDD development. Where in the lifecycle is the importance of code reviews and actually getting humans together to look at possibly what needs to be refactored?
We've spoken a little bit before about how my team works. We're on a mm-hmm. video call all day with one another and we swap out in 15-minute increments. We mm-hmm. are swapping out continually. We're practicing trying to describe to somebody what we would like to have done. We're also practicing operating as an intelligent keyboard. And I've heard a lot of people who work in the pair programming or mob programming space saying, well, actually, this is deaf to the pull request. We don't need to review our code because we're continually reviewing our code. And I actually feel strongly opposite that. And I think that my team would say the same thing. We laugh about it all of the time as we've heard people being embedded in different teams saying, oh, well, doesn't this mean that you don't need to do code reviews anymore? We find so many bugs or lines that we forgot to update, things that weren't found with PMD or whatever, but are just so obvious when you switch from that mindset of authoring to reviewing. I would never want to give that up. And I think it's actually a shame that, and this isn't something that's specific to Salesforce, right? This is like an industry-wide hate almost for pull requests. I know a lot of people who hate reviewing code. They view it as a chore. I love reviewing code. And I'm trying to impart this love to other people to encourage them to look at it more as an opportunity, not only to grow their own skills, but to be able to communicate empathetically with people in a way that ends up helping them improve in the future too.
Yeah. No, I love that. I think you hit spot on with the difference between an author flow and an editorial flow. It's, you know, when back in college, you would write your essay and just at the end of it, you just need somebody else to read it because your brain's just been stuck in this paragraph after paragraph mode. And you have to, you can't just instantly convert over to the other mindset of, did that actually work? Does it actually make sense?
Right. And I, you know, sometimes you almost are like, I can't actually look at this anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. I remember writing that 3 minutes ago. Of course, it's perfect.
Yeah. I don't need to look at it anymore.
I don't need to look at it anymore. I am good. Any tips for the code review? Like if somebody wants to get that skill, do you have like top of mind things to tell people?
You know, I learned recently, and I'd like to congratulate you as well, that our episode last year on open source was the most listened to podcast of 2022 for the Salesforce Developer Podcast. I'm going to keep continually come back to this, Josh, and keep beating that over the head, because I think if, especially if you're looking to grow your reading skills, the best place that you can do it is by looking through pull requests and open source repositories. And that doesn't even have to, it doesn't even have to be in the language that you're writing in. I'm always looking for unidiomatic applications of code when I'm doing code reviews. I'm trying to see things that are unusual. And when I get to something that's unusual, I'm looking to see, again, did the author express their intent well? Are they explaining this mystery that I'm looking at, right? Because there's a lot of really obscure things that you can do, but if you communicate your intent well, it sort of serves to tell the reader, oh, this person knows what they're talking about, or at least they claim that they do. And you can form your own opinion about that, of course. The judge is always out, right? The jury is for sure out. But
yeah,
I think that that is the best way to improve your reading skills and concomitantly your pull requesting skills as a reviewer, is go out there, look at reviews that have been done on the big Salesforce open source repositories, get a feel for what is idiomatic, get a feel for things that somebody says, well, wait a second, this looks interesting, actually. Maybe that wasn't meant to be in that specific method. Is that going to scale? Is that going to be a problem in some orgs where this feature isn't available? And you start to build up this, you know, mental model of, okay, these things are perfectly commonplace and ordinary, and sometimes it's okay to repeat yourself. You don't have to die on that dry hill versus things where you're like, oh, a query in a for loop. Yeah, that's going to be an immediate no. Like, let's talk about this, right?
Right. Nice. Any other books, podcasts, blogs that you recommend people read? You can even give a shout out to your own if you would like, that might help people get started with this kind of stuff.
I mean, I think that the Salesforce Developer blog is an incredible resource. Of course, I have my own blog at thejoysofapex.com, just joysofapex.com. My good friend and colleague, Jonathan Gillespie, published today on that site, actually, an incredible article, probably everything that you've ever needed to know about caching in Apex, for example. So we're really trying to do deep dives on interesting parts of the platform that can be used by pretty much anybody. And looking through those concepts, I think can really help to understand, okay, this is when I would use this particular kind of caching, for example.
Gotcha. Nice. Give me a brief overview of the blog post you just put out on Async Apex, combined Async Apex framework. Did I get that right?
Close enough. Yeah. Okay. You would know better than me at this point, right? I'm like in the post-review mindset of, oh, I wrote it. It's done.
Right.
Yeah. I think that this goes back to what we were talking about with operating as close to the metal as possible. I have tried to create a extremely low-cost abstraction that does all of the work for you as far as figuring out what kind of async process needs to be launched in Apex. So this thing will decide for you based on a set of records that you provide or a query string, do I need to batch or can I run this as a queueable real fast? So
gotcha.
I like this pattern a lot. I'm using it in several different open source applications with, I would like to say, great success. It's something that has helped me to put that part of the application and that part of the Salesforce platform in a box. It says, I don't want to worry about this anymore. I want to focus on the actual functionality that I'm trying to achieve. So let's put everything about asynchronicity into this box and let it handle deciding what to do.
And that's our show. Now, before we go, since we have talked to James a few times on the show, I asked him about his other favorite non-technical hobby.
Sourdough bread. Yeah. And sourdough pizza now, too.
Oh, nice.
My wife and I are big sourdough bread bakers. We have had a couple of starters now. In the sourdough community, I don't know if you're aware of this, but people like to talk about their like Civil War starter, like a starter that's been handed down for generations.
Oh,
we
really?
Don't have that. We've had to recreate the starter a couple times over the course of various moves and all that good stuff. But
gotcha.
I think that it's one of those activities that really helps you to decompress. There's really nothing like working with dough. But one of the other things that I also love about it is that it's the kind of thing that you tend to every half hour or every hour, let's say, over the course of a day. So when we're making bread, it might be an 8 hour long process of like getting the dough ready, but it's not a time consuming process. It's just not something that you can rush. And I think that goes back to the safety versus speed thing again.
Right.
You're not making sourdough bread in an hour.
I want to thank James for the great conversation and information. And as always, I want to thank you for listening. Now, if you want to learn more about this show, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear all episodes, see those show notes, and have links to your favorite podcast service. Thanks again, everybody. And I'll talk to you next week.